Part 3, Chapter 13, in which Harvey meets Heraclitus and J.C. goes through the fork. The light, from whose splendor the darkness flees, had already changed the color of heaven to blue, and the little flowers in the fields were lifting their heads, when Harvey awoke to an apartment that looked like a cage in the zoo. Parched and dehydrated from the night's offerings, he made his way to the door and descended to the street. The trees were in bloom, releasing their floating snow, and with each breath he took, he felt he was swallowing a mouthful of cotton. When he finally managed to breathe without choking, he spit out a tooth and walked to the west, fleeing from the rising sun. Before long, he reached the ravine of Memory Grove and the pond he had once swum in. There was a bridge to the north where a creek flowed in, and he walked over to it. He tried to imagine all the people who had stopped there before him, some seeking love or wealth or solitude, and some seeking to forget these things. And he considered that all people have a bridge within them, a place where they can pause to reflect, a suspended silence above the rushing stream. The water reminded him of his friend in southern France and inspired him to speak. O gliding Heraclitus, Sisyphus of the hills, year upon year has seen your tongue soften the stones, rolling down your slope, only to be returned to the top by the rain-swollen clouds. Flow on, my friend, flow on with winter snows, summer rains, and wayward rivulets in autumn. Flow on in ever-modern rapids, soon to be blended with the old streams of death. In you and me and everything, this same travail undertaking, these same currents flowing to the mystic ocean. Tending. Harvey picked up a pair of sticks and threw them into the current. But before he could see which was first to pass beneath the bridge, he saw his reflection on the shivering water, and he lowered his voice and addressed the stream again. O moving mirror, changing face that reflects this changing face, I sense in thee all rates and rhythms, and all teachings of life's transitory ways. I sense the rhythm of the rock, of the branch, and insect, and man. And I wonder how one ever meets another, rushing past like the water past the stone. Is it possible to tie our tempos together, to synchronize our steps? Or is there only union in stillness, in the unmarked meter of death? O liquid likeness, here I have friends, here I have Alessandra, here I have birds and mountains and trees. But still the travel tide rises, and I long for my future and my past. But the river answered not, or it answered with itself. And the captain left the bridge and continued up the canyon. Passing the gate to City Creek, he heard the sound of a flute by the water. "Pan," said Harvey, pushing through the reeds and branches. "Harvey," said Pan, when his friend came into view. After they embraced, his friend put down his flute and pulled out a handmade wooden censer. It was carved as the head of a panther, and the offering glowed in the holes of its eyes. "Arrgh!" purred Harvey, fixed in the fire of its gaze. After the offering, they sat and chatted, dining on green apples and wine, until they had had their fill and Pan picked up his flute. When he put his lip to the pipes, the entire grove seemed to draw near, and the beasts and birds circled around. He played a plaintive melody that told of the wandering moon and the toils of the sun, of the making of man and the creation of the creatures, and by the time he had finished, the grasses were swarming with nymphs, here a nymph, there a nymph, everywhere. And Harvey inflamed with cloven-hoofed desire. The captain didn't know which naiad to stalk first, so he stalked several at once, until he became a veritable tornado of pursuit. In an instant, the quiet woods were transformed into a whirlwind of movement, and when the hurricane finally settled, Harvey was still stalking a virgin around the elbow of the stream. When she too escaped, he returned to the clearing and discovered Pan had gone. Back on the road, the captain continued up the canyon. By now there were other people with him, running or biking along. He was passed by a pair of women who were jogging and complaining about men. They were angry that their companions were always contradicting themselves. Then he passed two men, making the same complaint about women. Contradictions, thought Harvey, astonished by the complaint. What is a person, if not a contradiction? Do you suppose I am the same person today you thought you knew yesterday? Is the stream the same? Is the flower? Is anything unaltered now from how you found it a moment before? I am equally altered, and being so altered, answer justly opposite the question answered an hour or a minute before. You ask for certainty? Permanence? You ask of a man what nothing in the universe can offer? You do not see that you who ask are not the one who asked before, nor the one who will ask tomorrow? Contradictions? I revel in contradictions. While he was reveling, the captain noticed two boys fishing in the creek, and he moved closer to watch them. Footnote. The editor could not believe it possible that two boys could be skillful enough to fly fish a stream as small as City Creek, until he discovered that their father was the renowned Sid Dryfly Nosevad. Back to the text. The younger boy was harmony personified, casting with a measured back and forth motion, tempting the instincts of the fish, feeling the relationship of air and insect and light, while the older one was an essay in clumsiness, bouncing his lure off the branches, catching it on one bank and then the other. At one point the older boy's fly strayed so far that it brushed the captain's nose, and when it happened again, Harvey flew after it. Thinking he was a yellow-bellied mosquito, Harvey followed its awkward arabesque, leaping at the line and trailing it to the surface of the creek. The tension of the water, though able to support the insect, was not equal to the buzzing captain, and he plunged straight through its smoothness to the shining stones beneath. The older boy cried out in glee, thinking he had caught a whopper, only to be disappointed when he found what was at the end of his line. Still, he didn't let that stop him from netting his catch, removing the hook and knocking Harvey's head on a stone. When the captain came to his senses, the boys invited him to play baseball at a park near their home. When they arrived at the field, there were a number of boys and girls gathered at the backstop. They were surprised to see a stranger, but it was not the first time an adult had come to play, and they quickly made him welcome. Although there seemed to be enough players, no one would pick teams. "What are we waiting for?" said Harvey. "J.C.," whispered one of the boys. "J.C.?" said Harvey. "He should be here," said the boy. "And if he doesn't come?" said Harvey. "We'll come back tomorrow." "And then the day after?" "Possibly," said the boy. "The point is..." "Until he comes," said Harvey. "Exactly," said the boy. Just then a breeze swept the field, and a flash of light streaked the sky. It was J.C., on his bike, swooping out of the sun with his long hair flying. The group clamored around him, kissing his ring and taking his pack. while his deep blue eyes gazed at them from beneath his red bandana. The narrator intervenes here. Dear reader, fans and fanatics, hail the white-haired god from the south and reserve your box seats in the park that J.C. built. The group knew little about their extraordinary friend. It was rumored he hailed from the shores of a distant neighborhood, that his father was a carpenter, and that he had known women. But of his life on the field there was nothing left to doubt. Faster than the wind, he routinely turned singles into triples, doubles into homers, and homers into a walk in the park. In only his first season, he set records in every hitting and fielding category, and his .883 average, 67 triples, and 42 home runs remained records until the park's final day. Footnote. Daniel Edward Byrne batted 1,000 that year, one for one with a bunt single, but did not have enough at-bats to qualify for the league lead. He did, however, qualify for the weekly beer-chugging contests, in which he was undefeated, 14-0. When the game was ready to begin, the sprinklers went on in right field. "We'll have to close right," said one of the boys. The group looked to J.C., but instead of nodding in agreement, he gestured to the outfield, knelt down on the grass, and turned the key that stopped the waters. A roar went up as he trotted to his place in center field. The game unfolded like the threads of an unwritten novel, each action determining and directing what followed. But a foreign element was added when a group of neighboring fraternity boys came to claim the field when the game was finished. Suddenly the object was not to win or to lose, but rather to prolong the game in a sort of 1,001 nights until the group that was waiting grew bored and went away. All that needed to be done was to make sure that the score was tied at the end of each inning, so that another inning had to be played. It was not difficult to do, and within the closed circle the competitive play could still be extraordinary. On defense, Harvey was positioned in center, and he had a perfect view of the field. He reveled in the freshness of the afternoon, the deep fragrance of grass, and the salty perspiration that cooled on his skin. But his play was sporadic, especially at the bat. Following the weakest player in the lineup, he took the bat with the same lack of confidence that the other had, and as he stepped to the plate, his personality became that of the bat, and, being the bat, Harvey was unable to hit the ball. By the third inning, J.C. sensed Harvey's predicament, and on a changeover, he put an extra baseball in the captain's pocket. Suddenly, becoming the ball instead of the bat, Harvey could not avoid hitting the pitch. Eventually, the group from the fraternity returned to their house, and the teams decided to play the last inning in earnest. The competition was fierce, but with two outs in the bottom of the inning, the bases loaded, and losing 27-24, J.C. stepped to the plate. Once again, he gestured to the outfield, but this time it was not to silence the waters, but to point out the forked tree in right center field. No one had ever put a ball between the fork, and that was what he proposed to do. Harvey, who was in center field, moved closer to the tree, and the entire park hung on every pitch. The first delivery was high, and J.C. let it pass. The second delivery was low, and he let it pass as well. Then the third delivery came in straight. Harvey was ready in the field, moving closer to the fork and pounding his glove. But before the pitch reached home base, Harvey began to take on the personality of the tree. He was just feeling the sap rise within him when the crack of the bat sent the baseball soaring. His teammates gasped with excitement, for they saw that Harvey was perfectly positioned, But when the rocket sped toward him, Harvey dropped his glove and raised his arms, and the ball passed between them. The players, stunned, began to cheer. "He put it through the fork! He put it through the fork! A called shot! Hosanna! The first one through the fork!" J.C. circled the bases, his feet whistling across the grass, and as soon as he was home, he was hit with a shower of questions. How did it feel, they wanted to know, putting it through the fork? J.C. heard their questions in silence and replied with a smile in his eyes. Then he packed his knapsack and called for his bike and sailed off into the sun. The group followed behind him, and soon the park was empty, except for the cottonwood captain, swaying with the breeze in his leaves.